Hello and welcome to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we're looking ahead at the Champions League, which admittedly has already started. We're profiling Real Madrid, Barcelona, Bayern Munich, and then we're opening up the burn book. While over on the paid side, we take a look at three more outside contenders for the competition before answering your questions in anything but football. That's all in this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back for another episode or two. Pete Dorman, how are you doing, man? Good to see you.
Hello. Good to see you too. I'm very well, Patrick. How are things with you?
Good, man. I've got nothing to report. I went on holiday. I liked it.
Yes, you were in Portugal, right? Lisbon?
No.
I was in further south.
I flew into Faro.
Mm.
But yeah, it was a really nice holiday.
there's a buck coming, right?
Yeah, with the caveat that the journey back made me regret that I was ever born.
Okay.
Like, they weren't even that bad, the girls, but I was miserable.
Right, okay. Because I remember speaking to you, I think, shortly after you'd arrived, and I think you said that on the way out, it was completely fine.
Well, Coco was sick, like, literally as we arrived.
Right.
Like, as we were pulling up at the villa, she, like, started being sick, like, last 10 minutes of a day-long journey. But I was just like, well, it's fine, because, like, once we arrived, she got out, and she was, like, happily running around. And, you know, like, it's one of those things where I was like, I don't really care that she was sick, like, from our point of view. It's just, like, miserable for her. Because you can't really explain to, like, a three-year-old that you're, like, you're a bit car sick, and we're about to get there, and then you'll feel fine. And sometimes, in fact, as soon as you're sick, you feel much better, right?
Yeah.
But it meant that on the way back, it started with that drive, and it's the drive that kind of made... So I was just like, if she's sick on this car journey, and she was like close the whole car journey for like an hour, I was like, if she's sick on this car journey, we've then got to get on a 3-hour flight and then like trains the other end, and the whole thing is going to be like bananas, and she's going to be so, so sad. So I was just like white knuckles the whole time. But it was great. It was a great holiday. Really relaxing.
So that was the whole reason why the entire journey home was so horrible. Just the fear of it going wrong. Or did it actually go wrong?
She was just... Well, there are also difficulties to, like, trying to get a baby to sleep on a plane who doesn't want to sleep. Sure. All that kind of shit. And, like... But really, yeah. Like, the majority of it was that, like, she was trying not to be sick in the car for, like, an hour. Then, like, on the flight, she was trying not to be sick towards the end because we were just, like, circling for ages, bit of turbulence. And I was like, oh, Jesus Christ. And then, like, when we got there, she, like, we had the travel pram with us. And we said, you can go in it. Like, the baby's in the carrier, so you can go in it. So we tried to put her in it. And she was, like, fighting and flailing. So we were like, fine, right, you can walk. And then, obviously, you know, when you're going through an airport, you're walking for miles.
Yeah.
And I was walking, and we were walking for miles with me, like, Emma pushing like a pram loaded with stuff and having a baby in a carrier, me pulling like suitcases and bags and all this kind of stuff while trying to control a toddler. Like, the whole thing, you're just like, it's bananas. And then doing like a platform change at Clapham Junction and stuff. Oh, the whole thing is
having
just crazy.
Having to go down, having to go back up. Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah.
Sounds fun.
Actually, and obviously the lift was broken to our
platform. Obviously, always. But the lift never worked.
Classic Clapham Junction. But what's going on with you? How are you doing? Like,
I'm good. Not much. I was back from France, struggling to reassimilate back into the expectations of my employer. Life was much easier when you could end at 6 p.m. French time and then go like get in the pool or sit in the sun or go for a cycle. Even though I like aggressively hate cyclists and disagree with their entire existence, when I go to rural France, I do change into one. So yeah, you know, going out on the bike at like 7 p.m. with the sun setting in rural France for like an hour, lovely. South London, slightly less appealing, slightly less alluring. But you know, I'm happy to be back. We're weirdly, I kind of feel like in a weird way, this will sound weird given the fact that I've actually been out of the country for about a month this summer. But it feels like summer has like passed me by. In that I was walking home from work yesterday at like 7 p.m. just before 7 p.m. and it was on the like it was like dusk. It was on the cusp of darkness, and I was like, it's 7 p.m. Like, surely it should be light for another 2 hours. Like, we're in the middle of summer. And then I realised it was, like, the third week of September. And for some reason this summer, maybe it's because we got married just before it, and then we went away for 2 weeks on our honeymoon, and then, like, life after that was just kind of, like, a bit weird trying to get back to, like... Nothing changed, but everything changed, if that makes sense.
Sure.
And it just seemed like this summer was completely different to all of the other summers in London I've had. Because, like, London, as much as I, like, complain about it, London in summer can be great. Like, yeah, it can. Like the pub culture and good weather in London, central London, like post-work, is incredible. And I just felt like I've completely, that's just completely missed me this year, for whatever reason.
But you're an old married man now.
I did think that might be the factor, but I don't think that it would have that quick an impact. Because I'm also still, like, I'm actively not drinking. It's not like I've become, like, boring, or I don't, like, drink anymore, or anything to do with that. Not that not drinking makes you boring or not. But like, tonight, for example, I've said I'm not going to drink tonight because I'm going to drink for the next, like, 4 nights straight, because a few friends are over from Belfast on Friday for the weekend. Then one of my friends just happens to be in London from Scotland on Monday. We've just come back from 2 weeks in France, where while I was working for one of the weeks, that was essentially treated like a two-week holiday in terms of my approach to it. So we're talking, like, lunchtime beers, like fresh baguette, cold meat sandwich. So, like, the amount, like, the frequency at which alcohol has been consumed over the past month has been quite staggering. There's been so many scenarios that have presented themselves in which that was appropriate. You really need to, like, batten down on the ones that, when it's not as appropriate. You really need to grasp them, because specifically this month, they've come at a premium. Even to the point of, this podcast happens twice a month. At least we record twice a month. And for me, I kind of approach it part work, part social event. And there was a real dilemma just before we started recording, because I learned that you were drinking, which is far more rare than me drinking on this podcast.
Yeah, it's unusual.
And that almost tipped me, being like, okay, well, it would be rude not to. I'm anything but rude. That was the nice sound of a spicy margarita can being opened.
A gift from you.
I know. I was very open about using you as a guinea pig, though, because I am in the market for a good spicy marg can.
It's not the worst experimentation that I've suffered. I'm fine with that. Well, so before long, you know, you'll be just like me. You'll be drinking, like, once every 2 months.
Yeah.
Like, Taco will be starting school.
Yeah.
And
two drinks, and I'm like, phew, loser.
Yeah, you're just like, Jesus, what a big night.
That's some strong session IPA. 3% has gone straight to my head.
I tell you what, man, it makes life cheaper. Right, sometimes I go out and I'm like, right, I had two drinks, and I could get in a fight.
Yeah.
You know, I'm absolutely raring today. All right, that's enough of that, because we've got quite a lot of teams to cover today. So obviously the Champions League has started, some games happened last night. By the time you hear this, the whole first round of games would have happened. So we wanted to talk over the new Champions League format a tiny bit, our thoughts on it anyway, and, like, cover some of the European teams who everybody just kind of, every discussion about it I've seen is just like, well, Real Madrid won last year and Real Madrid have got Mbappe now, so they'll definitely win this year. And that's kind of as far as I've seen the conversation go. And also, I think Real Madrid have had quite a weird start to the season, and I think a bunch of other teams are quite interesting, so we thought it'd be nice to take a little tour of the continent, especially because in previous years everyone was kind of siloed off in their separate groups, right?
Yeah.
So, like, if a group had, you know, Bayern Munich in it, and then it had
like Liverpool,
or not even a Prem club, it had like Bayern Munich and it had like Milan and it had like two bumfuck clubs,
yeah,
then you would be like, I don't need to pay attention to that group. Sure, yeah, Bayern Munich going to win that group.
Yeah.
Whereas now, because everybody's in the same league, technically you kind of have to pay attention to everybody. I truly don't remember who's playing whom. Like, I looked at Arsenal's fixture list today,
it's,
and I was
crazy.
Like, oh yeah, we're playing the Inter. We're playing Inter and we've got PSG. All right, okay.
Yeah.
Sure, don't know. So I don't know. The first thing I kind of want to say is, like, what do you think of this league system? Because straight away, I hate it.
I don't know if I hate it. I think I might hate it. I don't feel I have enough information to confirm that I definitely hate it. So I'll be interested to see how this, like, at least the first stage. Obviously, once we get to the knockouts, it's standard Champions League. Or at least post-playoff knockouts.
Sure.
But my main kind of two takeaways
I have an argument against that, but yes, go
okay, on. Sure. My main two takeaways from the new structure is that, one, I fear that it can devalue the mega clashes that happen in, like, the knockout stages, because it's very rare it's reasonably rare that you'll get multiple big clubs playing each other in the group stages. You might get one group of death, maybe, but outside of that, you're not going to have, like, the champions, like, you physically couldn't have the champions of, like, Italy play the champions of England in the first round, which is Man City's first game, right? Man City Inter, I think that's tonight, is it?
Yeah, it's tonight. Yeah, it's like happening,
yeah, it's
now.
It's just started. So, like, literally, first off the bat, first game out for City are against the Italian champions.
The team that is, like, the according to Opta's like model, right? These are like, this is the number one team in the tournament the versus the number three team in the tournament. You're like, that's
game week
weird.
One. It's just it's really strange. And I think while it puts more, while it increases the number of these big games across the tournament as a whole, it kind of devalues their like potency and their importance. Because when it comes to like a round of 16 or like last eight knockout game, and it's two teams that could actually feasibly win it, it could two teams that are good enough to contest the final, and they're playing like the round of 16, you're like, fucking hell, like this is a huge game, like a really season defining game across two legs here against two great teams. Like this is what the Champions League's made for. And it kind of dilutes a lot of the potency of that. And I feel like once you get to the Champions League later stages, you'll have these games again and you'll be like, well, okay, this'll be the third time these teams play this year. And it's like, it just loses a little bit of its novelty. And the other thing is, it absolutely kills the small teams. Like, there's always like the hope of like a minnow team, like a little bumfuck team, being able to like get a couple of like really shock results against the big team in their group.
It's like have two bumfucks in like the first seven. Yeah. We're like really, really like shit talking. They're just like, oh, some little Eastern European nation or whatever. It's like,
yeah, well, isn't there a Bratislavan team in there this year?
Yeah, the Slovan Bratislava. Yeah. They're playing Celtic tonight, but I mean Celtic, they're barely bigger.
Yeah. But yeah, so like it makes it virtually impossible, because before they could scrape a couple of like shock results, have other results in the group go their way and just somehow find themselves in like second place on goal difference or something. And then all of a sudden they've got a knockout game, which is like incredible for that club. It's kind of, it's emblematic of what the Champions League should be. It's you know, it's a great story. But now that it's over a league season, now it's over two more games as well, it's virtually impossible, because not only do they need to get more results, it's impossible for every other result in the league across the 36 teams to go in their favour, so much so that they definitely will not get in the top eight. And even if they get inside the top 24, they then will have to play a playoff against a decent Champions League team across two legs just to get into the knockout stages, at which point a team like that will likely get found out. And it's just, it basically just removes all of that, like the fantastic movie line stories are kind of not killed. And I just don't love it. Because it pretty much just means the big teams will stretch away. It gives the bigger teams a greater advantage than they already had, because they have more games, and it also doesn't matter if they drop points because they have enough time. They have more time to make it right, and also because they're not siloed off in a little four-person group. When they drop points, it's not as bad. Like, worst-case scenario, they need to play a playoff. For a big team, worst-case scenario, because they're not finishing 25th, 336. Like, worst-case scenario, they get a playoff, and then they'll be better than that team anyway across two legs, so they'll... It'll be catastrophic for some of the like top six, top eight teams to not reach the knockout proper stages. And for me, that isn't really what the Champions League has been about since it started.
Yeah. So I think part of the idea was, like, obviously they just wanted more games.
Yeah.
Like that's priority one, and bigger games. Yeah. And I think in one sense it succeeds, as in like, it's not going to be the problem we've had in the Champions League, which has been teams just playing feeling like the same fixtures every year. Like, there are obviously the long periods where you're just like, oh, it's Barca PSG every year, or it's Arsenal Bayern every year, it's Real Madrid City every year. Like, it's often felt like we get the same fixtures again and again. And this theoretically gives you opportunity for like other kind of rivalries to come about, because, like, you know, eight different teams in the league stage. And that means that you can, I suppose, like, develop a different sort of like rivalry with one of those teams. But I just don't see how you do that in one game, because you don't have the return fixture. Yeah. It's just like, because it chops and changes all the time. It just...
And also there's such less jeopardy in that game as well, because if you lose that game, it's not overly definitive, because it's not like you need to come back and make up that deficit 2 weeks from now in an away leg against the same team. Yeah. Or it's not like that team essentially that's a six-pointer because that team is in the same group as you and you've dropped points and they've gained points. Because it's all a big like group, or it's all a big league structure. It's like, yeah, okay, it's a big game against two big teams and the football should be decent, but also there's no real jeopardy, because if they're both big teams...
Only 12 teams get knocked out. It's barely anything. Yeah, exactly. So we're in a situation in, say, the Premier League, for example, where, like, Arsenal's game against City at the weekend is probably more definitive for their title chances than their game against Atalanta tomorrow night. Like, if Arsenal lose, like, in theory, it should be that, like, the Champions League, fewer games, so if you lose one of those games, bigger deal. Yeah. Whereas in the league, you're like, oh, you've got 38 matches, so if you lose one of them, it's, like, not that big. You've got plenty of time to come back. But, like, realistically, you've got so much more room to drop points in the new Champions League structure than you do, say, if you're trying to win the Premier League, that it just means, like, who cares? Like, we'll rotate for that game. Whereas it used to be, no, we'll rotate for the game after the Champions League. So, so I think that sucks a bit. Yeah, I don't know. It just... And it's just... It is just too many fixtures. I just can't get excited for it. I quite liked... developing a beef with different clubs. I quite like as much as like we had a really rough ride against Bayern Munich, I kind of liked that it was just like, fuck Bayern Munich, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I was kind of up for it. Whereas in these games, I'm just like, after one game, I'm not going to hate that club. It's just not possible. Like, I'm not going to have like some beef with them after one game when I probably won't play them again until next season. Like, I just don't really get that. And I completely agree with what you said about it devaluing some of the bigger fixtures, because by the time we go through to the knockout stages, I'll have seen like Liverpool play Real Madrid or whatever. I'll have seen PSG play Bayern Munich. I will have seen these fixtures, and I won't really have any clue how good any of those sides are, because half of your fixtures are against crap teams and maybe three or four max are against good teams. Like, PSG have the hardest schedule, and they've got like four tough teams, but most clubs have like three tough teams realistically. Mm-hmm. I just feel like we're going to go into the knockouts with me basically thinking like, I don't know how good any of these sides really are. I have just watched like a ton of games, which pretty much I could have just like knocked off these. I'm sure there'll be at least a couple of surprises, but I could probably just like name the clubs that are not going to go through for sure.
Yeah.
Like, before we start, it just feels a bit demoralizing. And like, now we've got players as well coming out and saying like, there are too many games.
Yeah.
Like, we can't put up with this. Nobody asks us before they expand these formats. We're the ones who've got to play. And I just think, well, what it's actually much more likely to end up with is like Man City winning their first five games and then playing kids for their remaining three, because they just don't care.
It's so,
I don't know.
It's I just think it's I've got the fixtures up here like on the Champions League website, and one, just the volume of them is staggering. Trying to scroll through them all, it's just like it's basically like scrolling through an Excel sheet full of data. And it just feels like this is going to get very tiring very quickly. Like, the volume is too great and it's too saturated to pull anything substantial or enjoyable out of it, at least not more so than the old format. It just feels so much harder to get your head around, because there's so much going on, there's too much happening, and you feel like, I feel like I'm going to miss a load of stuff this tournament that you wouldn't have missed in the previous format.
Yeah, there are just too many games on at the same time. It's impossible. So, I don't know. I just don't really get it. And it's just so obviously a cash grab that I find it infuriating. Yeah. But just looking down this list, I'm just like, there are so many clubs here and I just don't care. Like Young Boys. Was it Young Boys? Yeah, Young Boys got the absolute shit kicked out
by Villa.
By Villa. And they've got to go to like Barcelona away. And then they've got Inter and Atalanta at home. And I just think, like, if you get hammered by Aston Villa, what is going to happen against this Barcelona side? Like, it's just like, what is the point of this shit? Like,
hammered at home as well.
Like you say, like, it used to be set up in such a way that the system kind of benefited. So Dortmund, for example, last year, Dortmund are not like true minnows. Obviously, they're like a big club, but they were dog shit last year. They were not very good domestically.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't that good in the Champions League, but they won their group because of a few lucky bounces, and that was a massive factor in them getting to the final. Like,
yeah,
it put them on the side on a, it put them like on a run of fixtures which were very winnable, rather than putting them into an incredibly difficult. Like, obviously, they could have still got a tough draw, but they might have also just gone out in the round of 16 if they hadn't won the group. So that feels like a reward for getting lucky or for playing particularly well in a couple of key moments. And this time you're just like, there are so many games that it's kind of impossible that you would go on a hot run. You know, like, Bologna are not going to go on a hot run and beat like Aston Villa away and Liverpool away. Like, it's just not going to happen. Like, though I think Bologna are okay. I don't know why I picked Bologna. But you know what I mean? Like, it just feels like there's far less scope for upset. It's not even particularly equitable, because when I look at the toughest draw here, which is like PSG's, I think it's so much tougher than like the easiest draw. The easiest draw is Celtics. They've got Dortmund away, Leipzig at home, Atalanta away, Bruges at home.
Yeah.
Somebody else. Who the fuck's that?
But so the fact that they got Dortmund and Leipzig out of pot one is crazy.
I know. I know. And then you've got like young boys and like Villa away and like Benfica at home. Like that's their fixture list. Whereas PSG have like Bayern away, City at home, Arsenal away, Atletico Madrid at home. Like, yeah, this is crazy. And so you just look at stuff like that and you're like, okay, so there's not really much fairness in this at all.
Yeah.
Like, it's not... there's kind of no level on which this succeeds, I think, really. Or no important level on which it succeeds, I guess I should say. So I'm not that excited about it. However, I just kind of hope that in 2 years they're like, let's just go back to the old format, but they won't.
No.
So should we talk then about a couple of teams? Because like Real Madrid, it's quite boring hearing people talk about Real Madrid, because like obviously if you see like, you know, the kind of ex-pros who are like BBC pundits or something, then they're like, Real Madrid are going to win it. Real Madrid won it last year and like they've had a Kylian Mbappe, they're going to win everything. And I think they never seem to bother like watching the games or like thinking about what's going on. Yeah. It's just always, well, this is what happened last year, so I guess it will happen again. And look, it makes sense. Real Madrid and Man City are the two favourites for this competition. That makes sense. They're probably going to be the two best teams in it. Real Madrid are not one of the best teams around at the moment. They're not playing very well at all. That's not going to be an issue. They're obviously going to be great in the end. But they are kind of in a weird zone right now. Like, they are not top of the league in Spain.
No.
And not only that, but they're, like, deservedly not top. Like, Barcelona have been amazing. Yeah. And Real Madrid have been, like, kind of ropey. And even in their first game last night, like, against Stuttgart, they were at home and they gave up 17 shots at home to Stuttgart, who are not great. And like, yeah, they won the game, but that kind of thing just makes me, it doesn't make me worried for them or anything, but it does make me think, okay, well, maybe I adjust their odds of winning the competition down by like 1 or 2%. Don't get me wrong. We know that by February or March, they'll be way better than they look now. But at the same time, there are other teams that look really, really good now and can continue to improve over the season. So I don't know. I would like it to be a bit more complicated than, well, it's Real Madrid or Man City and that's it. I'd love for those teams to get each other like quite early on in the knockouts and just open the field up a bit. Because, yeah, I don't know. Like, if the whole point was to like change up the format, make things less predictable or whatever,
yeah,
if we still end up in a situation where we're like, well, it's going to be Real Madrid or Man City, then what has it achieved?
Yeah, I think you're totally right, because it's one thing to try and make it less predictable, but at the same time, we just witnessed a final in which Dortmund got to it, which I don't believe anybody in their like right mind would have predicted Dortmund to go to the final.
Sure.
So I don't really see how this new format actually makes it more difficult for the best teams to go as far as they usually go. They got more chances. They have got a longer time in which to do it. So like Real Madrid can kind of stumble through this league system, as they might well do, and it actually not really damage them at all. By the time they're up to speed, they're in the knockouts, and then they, you know, a fairly simple, or they'll just naturally make their way to the final or the semi-final, as they always do. I don't see how this new system makes it any more difficult for them to do that than the old system. I actually think it makes it quite a substantial bit easier. But I think City are definitely the favourites, undoubtedly. I think they have Real a second, but I think Madrid are quite a distant second in terms of favourite, because I'm not completely sold on this Madrid team, because they've obviously added Mbappe, incredible player. They've added Endrick, seems like a very, very good player.
Yeah, but he's been really good.
I think that has kind of blinded everybody to issues that lie out with their attacking prowess, because there are some things there that are of concern. And like you said, they haven't had a great start to the season. They're already 4 points back off Barca. I think they dropped points against Mallorca and Las Palmas. Struggled against Stuttgart. You know, while they did win, like you said, but in the 80th minute, that game was 1-0. And Stuttgart caused them problems. And this is a Stuttgart that like isn't the Stuttgart that was the Stuttgart that qualified. This is a different Stuttgart as well. This is a weaker Stuttgart. So I think that shows you kind of straight up that there are some issues to work through. One of the biggest ones being the fact that Toni Kroos has retired. And now there's kind of a big hole in that midfield. There's a big hole in that dressing room. Nacho, their club captain, also left. So they're missing their kind of talismanic metronomic central midfielder that's been there for seemingly ever. They're missing their club captain. And while they've added the best player in the world and an incredibly young talented forward, there is a lot of uncertainty with their midfield and their defence. So in the midfield, Valverde's emerged as like the crew successor. Took his shirt off his back as well, you know, RIP. Very, very cold in the ground before he's ripped the shirt off his back. But he's performed well. Tugumeni's played alongside Amosi because Camavinga and Bellingham have both spent time out injury. Valverde's got 3 goal involvements in his first 7 games, if you include the Super Cup, which I did to slightly inflate his output.
Sure.
But he's been good. Tugumeni also leads the league in touches, successful passes, passing percentage. Valverde's third in all of those. Like, they have been good. And the caveat as well to this is that we still have Camavinga to come back, and Bellingham came back this week, played 80 minutes against Stuttgart. So things have been fine, and they've not been great. They've not been amazing. And I suppose their, like, production numbers from midfield have been quite low. I think Valverde is the only Madrid player with over 1 expected goal outside of Vinicius. Mm-hmm. Nobody else has accrued over 1 expected assist, in the Real Madrid squad, outside of Valverde and Vinicius across the first 5 games, which isn't great. But they need time to adapt to life with their crews. They've also changed their system. You know, Bellingham was playing that kind of 10 role in a 4-4-2 last year to kind of make up for the fact that they didn't replace Benzema. They've now got Mbappe playing through the middle. Bellingham's dropped a bit further back. They're playing like a 4-3-3. But they're also moving to like a 4-4-2 and out of possession, because you have to mitigate for Mbappe's like fairly non-existent defensive intensity or output. Kind of similar to how they had to mitigate for Benzema at the end, not really doing much up top defensively.
Sure.
So there are a lot of things that are slightly different than last year. And there are a lot of big players, or there are a few big players who are no longer there. They, you know, because of the Mbappe-Bellingham dynamic now that exists, they're kind of shifting in the lower block, which isn't the worst thing, because if you think about how they played against the big teams last year, they kind of sacrificed a lot of possession and just looked to hit on the counter because of kind of the players they had in Vinicius and Rodrigo and in Bellingham's kind of late runs. So I don't think that's a terrible thing to do, but also it could just come with a bit of teething problems. And the biggest and most damning thing for me with this Real Madrid squad is there are going to be a lot of games this year. We've already spoken about, looking at the fixture list just in Champions League, how extensive it is and also how kind of demanding it is, because you're playing a lot more top-end opposition a lot more frequently. There's players talking about going on strike. You know, this is a very, very congested season, coming off the back of a congested summer with the Euros. And Real Madrid are coming into it with basically 2 fit centre-backs, and that's about it. You know,
And last season, they already were having to use Tchouaméni there.
Yes, like, quite a bit.
And now they're like, well, we've lost a midfielder.
Yeah.
We've lost Nacho. And we've lost a centre-back.
And we sold Rafa Marin to Napoli.
Yeah, but we're going to kind of go again with like the same personnel. Like, that does seem a bit foolhardy.
And it was clear that they were looking to reinforce this position, because they went in for Lenny Euro. Like, they set pretty rigid terms on that deal, and that obviously meant that he ended up at United, but they were very public in their pursuit of him. And it felt like as soon as he went to United, they just kind of stopped. And, you know, reportedly Ancelotti wanted to explore other options, because he obviously looked at his squad and was like, we have 2 centre-backs and a long season, we need someone. And Madrid were basically like, Lenny Euro or no one. And even these centre-backs, they're not like perpetually fit centre-backs, because their only fit centre-backs were coming in to the season are Militao and Rudiger. Now, Militao missed 45 games last season, having torn his ACL. Rudiger, whose fitness has actually been pretty good, but he does have arthritis in his knee, which might not be a concern, but it's a little bit of a flag. It's a difficult injury to consistently play through, put it that way. Arthritis. So that is
and then
a true.
And they've got Alaba, who's like never injured.
Wait. Well, I mean, he'll be back, what, maybe November, probably December. Mm-hmm. Then, like you said, you've got Tchouaméni coming in as an auxiliary centre-back. And outside of that, you've got, like, literal academy, you're calling up youth player. Like, that's pretty much it. Or you've got to play, like, Carvajal at centre-back. And for a squad that is tipped as probably the second favourite, for people who are saying, oh, Real Madrid, credit where credit's due, huge prowess in the tournament. I think they've won 6 of the last 11, which is insane. But I just don't see how you can be that in on Madrid, especially just because of the Mbappe. And Mbappe's factor is a thing, you know. I think he scored 4 goals in his last 2 games, or 3 games. So he is starting to heat up. But I just see, like, this is a long season, and they have fairly thin and fairly injury-prone central defensive...
Yeah.
A central defensive unit. In a season, coming off the back of a congested summer with the Euros, in which a lot of the Real team featured into the knockouts, or into the final, a number of them, into a longer Champions League season against better opposition at a more frequent rate. I just don't see how, like, it feels like a bit house of cards in the fact one injury, 1.5 injuries could take this Real Madrid team from being like second favourite to being like 10th favourite. And it's not a really, it's not an ideal situation to be in if you're a Madrid fan, if I'm being honest. And I am significantly more down on Madrid this season than I was last season, even though they've added Mbappe and Endrick.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. Like, because it's not, like, we're not saying they're not going to be really good. They are going to be really good, especially like once Alaba's back. Like, realistically, they're going to be fine because they're going to get through this league stage of the Champions League, like, no worries. And then all they've got to do is make sure everyone's fit. But like, competing on two fronts, which they are actually going to have to do this season, because Atleti are better and Barcelona are way better.
Yeah.
Like, that plus more fixtures plus a thinner squad, I don't know, like, I do think that they're maybe a little bit overvalued in the market, like, for this competition. So I don't know, I think I'm kind of intrigued as well. Like, the Liverpool away game that they have,
yeah, it's big.
It's not big in the sense that it doesn't matter.
It doesn't mean anything, but it's a big game. But it's like a big indicator.
It's a really interesting one. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, because Liverpool have looked fantastic this season so far, and Liverpool away, even if Liverpool are looking bad, is a horrible match.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, for a long time, everyone's been like, it's Real Madrid and they just find a way to win and blah, 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 blah. And like, they've got lucky a lot. But like, also, gradually, a bunch of those guys have gone.
Yeah.
So the personnel who were the personnel who always got lucky, you know, the Kroos's, Modric, Carvajal, like, all these guys, like, gradually they are all going. And we're now basically left with like one of them. One or two of them, which is like Modric and Carvajal. Like, that's,
yeah, but they're also significantly older now as well.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not saying that like suddenly they're going to start losing these games, but it's weird that we kind of think like Real Madrid as an institution,
yeah,
are like incapable of losing. Real Madrid have built like a really good squad, but there are worries about it.
Yeah.
And if they get unlucky in, say, February, March, instead of getting unlucky in like October, November, they could quite quickly find themselves in a sticky situation. And yeah, like, you look at City, and City have got more Haaland reliant this season, but I just back City. I'd back City to deal with a period without Haaland.
Yeah,
much better than I would back Real Madrid to deal with a period without Rudiger.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think if Haaland doesn't score those goals, somebody else will eventually. And instead of Haaland scoring a hat trick, like, I don't know, somebody else scores one goal. They get it done because they're good enough as an entity. I think the most damning thing for Madrid's defence is that The Athletic reported, I think last week, that one of their Madrid insiders basically said that Ancelotti and his staff expect to concede 10 to 15 more goals this season than they did last season, based on the current defensive makeup of the squad. But while that's a concern, obviously that's a huge amount of extra goals to concede, they feel they're just going to make it up with the additions of Endrick and Mbappe.
That's probably true.
Which is true, but it is a damning statement for like their defensive capabilities and the capabilities of this like this defensive unit.
I also just think that's a really weird way to like think about it. To be like, we're going to give up loads more goals, but like, we're going to score more goals. And basically, not to be like, we're going to adjust to the personnel we have and like,
but also,
it'll be totally different.
I agree it's mental, I do think it is quite fitting for Real Madrid. It's a very Real Madrid mentality. I think they're well, sure, it's fine. We'll just outscore it. Like, we've got Vinicius, we've got Rodrigo, we've got Endrick, we've got Mbappe. Like, we'll just outscore them.
It's just kind of funny, though, because like, their defence has looked really good so far this season. Their attack hasn't looked great. Shall we move on then to Barcelona? Because I think Barcelona are a bit more interesting, because like, Barcelona, like, no one really had high hopes for them going into the season. No one really thought about it.
Mm.
I had to remind myself that Hansi Flick was their boss. But they have been so good so far. Like, and they just have an academy kid for every problem. Like, obviously they had Marc Bernal, who was playing really well and then got injured. Now they've got Casado, who's come in, who I don't think is like on the level of Bernal, but he doesn't seem to be a problem for them. They've got Pau Cubarsí playing centre back. Obviously they've got Pedri, they've got Gavi coming back from injury at some stage. Lamine Yamal is just like a world class footballer, I guess. We didn't really like their window, like bringing in Dani Olmo, but like only because we were like, it's too much money and they could do something else with this money. And I think that's kind of true. Like, Frenkie de Jong is apparently just coming back from injury, but realistically,
is he ever coming back?
He's back in training, I think, today.
Right, okay.
So if they'd brought in like another central midfielder instead of an attacking midfielder, then I would probably, you know, feel they were a little bit more injury proof.
Yeah.
Because they brought in Olmo in a position where they've used Rafinha so far this season, where Pedri can play. Like,
yeah.
I just don't think that they have an issue in that zone. But only PSG, Europe-wide, can beat their expected goal difference right now. They're conceding under a goal a game. They are scoring more than 3 goals a game. They've got 13 XG through 5 games, which is just, like, ridiculous. They look incredible when you watch them. They've got a ton of the ball, but they're not, like, pass you to death, Barcelona. They are cut right through you, Barcelona. Only Leverkusen are taking more shots than them. They're taking 19 shots a game, which is also, like, staggering stuff, really. I don't know, man. Like, I don't know if they're necessarily, like... Okay, so they're pressing really hard, and, like, they're getting a lot of defensive work out of guys like Yamal. Like, that's kind of really important to keeping this ticking over. Central midfield is a bit of a weakness. Like, I love Pedri, but he's not, like, a defensive, no, like, powerhouse.
Not at all.
Gavi is a bit better in that regard, but Gavi's not really that either. Casado isn't that. Bernal's going to be out for the season. So, to me, a really good Barcelona probably does include, like, a fit De Jong.
Yeah, that's a Frankie De Jong-shaped hole right there. Like, yeah, even though he's not perfect, also, but it just is, yeah.
And you would also not be surprised if he comes back and, like, Hansi Flick's like, I just like these kids, we're going to play these kids. Like, De Jong's kind of, like, out of contract at some stage. Like, or we'll potentially move De Jong on next summer, so why would I invest minutes in him? But De Jong...
I mean, the club are definitely trying to shift his wages, for sure.
Yeah, they'll be delighted. Like, when his wages are off the book, kind of like Lewandowski. Like, they still like Lewandowski. But when Lewandowski's wages are off the book, I think they will be...
He'll age out, whereas, like, the contract that was given to Young is mental, especially considering how injured he is. And, like, Barcelona have been very, very open about trying to shift him on and trying to free up that cap space. So, yeah,
which is why I wouldn't be surprised if he, like... If he's somewhat peripheral. But I also wouldn't be surprised if he comes back and he's just a starter, because I think that zone on the pitch is weak. And Gundogan left.
Yeah,
and Gundogan isn't, like, a real CM, but, like, Gundogan going out and Olmo coming in is... a more attacking substitution.
That's really interesting, because obviously I know Gundogan went, and obviously I know Gundogan is back at City, but my brain didn't connect the dots that doesn't mean he's also now not at Barca.
Yeah, I know, right? Like, because you never really noticed that he was at Barca, to be honest.
Yeah.
But he had a good season last year, and admittedly, he was playing an attacking role, but, like, he is a useful guy to have in controlling games, and these young guys are great, but...
They're young.
When you're not trying to control a game versus Vallecano or Girona, when you're trying to control a game against Manchester City or Arsenal or Bayern Munich, like, or whoever it is, it's a significantly different, like, kettle of fish. So the attack is great, but I do think there is that weakness in central midfield. However, the press does look really effective, and Rafinha has been just, like, absolutely on fire to start. Absolutely on fire. He's got, like, 5 goal involvements in 5 games. He's at 1.13 expected goals and assists per 90 minutes. Lewandowski's at 1.15. And then Yamal and Olmo are both around 0.9. Like,
Jesus.
It's everybody in the attack is eating.
Mm.
Though Dani Olmo, of course, is immediately injured. But with Gavi coming back and De Jong coming back, if those guys both come back, then you look at this and you're like, that squad could feasibly beat basically anybody. And Hansi Flick's just doing a really, really good job. So I think Barcelona, it's kind of like when a team is out of the conversation for a while, everyone just, like, disregards them entirely. And, like, no one's really talking about them seriously. But Barcelona could quite easily win La Liga this season.
Yeah.
In fact, I would not be surprised if that happens. And so it's weird to say, well, Real Madrid are obviously, like, one of the favourites for the Champions League, but the team that might beat them to the title in Spain is like, no real danger for European trophies at all. So, I don't know. I'm like, mildly Barcelona curious.
I kind of feel their squad set up for better success in La Liga than it is in the Champions League, though. And
why is that?
I just think it's just more robust, and it's got more longevity than Real Madrid. You can cobble together a good Real Madrid squad for the 16 games you'll play in the Champions League. Will it be 16 now the whole way to the final?
Depends if you play.
You can even with injuries, you can cobble together a very good Real Madrid team that can get it done. I think across a 38 game season in La Liga, there will be stretches where they're missing very, very big players and they don't have significant cover. Barcelona, on the other hand, I think have the ability to deal with that more, shown in the fact that they weren't great last season, they have dealt with big injuries, long injuries, multiple times across the last few seasons. I just think they're more well-equipped to go at a higher rate for a longer period domestically, but I am not convinced that they can get or I'm not convinced they're, they have as significant a possibility or significant of a likelihood of beating a big team across two legs in like the first round of the Champions League knockout.
I mean, sure. But at the same time, as we said, like you chuck in Gavi and De Jong.
Yeah.
You take out Casado and like somebody else, and then you've just got like so much talent in there. Like Lewandowski and Yamal plus Olmo or Rafinha or both is just like quite a scary prospect. And the expectations are so low, but going to Barcelona is still like quite an intimidating thing. And they've actually got a really easy group stage. Their group stage, they can, I think, walk through. They've got Young Boys, Bayern, Brest and Atalanta, Monaco, Red Star, Dortmund and Benfica. And like...
That is quite nice, actually.
Bayern is the only game there where Barca are not enormous favourites. And even then, against Bayern. So, I don't know. That's an interesting one. I mean, but I guess it maybe is a good point to move on to Bayern. Because I honestly don't know what to make of them. Like, what do you... You've done some research on Bayern. But, like, on the one hand, I'm like, they're better last year than they ended up looking because they came third. But then I also think they hired Vincent Kompany and I don't know if he's any good. Like I just have so many kind of like, plus I think the Bundesliga was absolutely dog shit last season. I just have a load of questions about Bayern Munich.
Yeah, I mean, I also don't really know what to make of them this season. I think they obviously had a horrendous season by their standards last season in the fact that they won absolutely nothing. Which is hilarious for Harry Kane.
But it's amazing.
Outside of the Vincent Kompany addition, I quite like what they've done this summer. And I think they are... I think their squad's actually in like low-key kind of pretty good position. I think they obviously added Elise, who was great in the Premier League. And he's also like a more creative inside right option than Sané offers. So it kind of adds a little bit of a new dimension or another dimension to their attacking stable. Polina, I think, is the biggest or most essential signing they've made. You know, he adds some much-needed bluntness to that central midfield that kind of generally lacks combativeness. For Fulham, he was averaging like 5 tackles per 90, top 1%. Like he led the league for 2 seasons in tackles completed. And for comparison, right, Declan Rice, Bruno Guimarães and Caicedo all registered about 90 tackles last year in more minutes than it took Polina to register 152. So there are factors there that Fulham are shit and he's in more demand.
Are shit.
Like that or worse shit, they still are. That is obviously a factor in that, but like this guy has consistently been a very, very good but blunt instrument in the middle of midfield in the Premier League for 2 seasons. And that's kind of what Bayern have been missing for a number of seasons now. So I think like that is a big plus, a big addition to their squad. They've also added a decent left-sided ball-playing central defender and Hiroki Ito, who I think is injured at the minute, but once he gets up and running, I think he'll be a decent addition in a rotation of centre-backs. And while I don't love Kompany, and I really don't love Kompany, I think he's a glorified PE teacher, in a way, you can kind of spin it as a positive for Bayern, because one of the biggest issues with Tuchel was that he was not, like, nobody puts baby in the corner, right? He was not willing to be the puppet with the boar's hand, like up his arse, essentially. Like he wasn't.
Do you say the board?
The board
with
doesn't
a D. Like,
B-O-A-R-D.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you said like it sounded like you said the boar, as in like you know like the
B-O-R-E.
Wild pig.
Oh, B-O-A-R.
I was like that could, you know, like if they were just like this guy, you know, like Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, like his nickname is the boar. Yeah. Or something like that. But please carry on. It was for a moment, it took me out of it.
Yeah, it went quite dark and quite strange there quite quickly. But he obviously was not willing to be, like, to basically just be a yes man and follow order. He wanted genuine control. He wanted genuine input. And that kind of never really came. And he got removed from his position. And it feels like Kompany, who, bearing in mind, got relegated last season with Burnley, is now in the Bayern Munich job, and it feels like he's just happy there. Like, Tuchel wanted to be the head of the table. Kompany is just happy to have a seat at the table. Like, Kompany's basically like feeding off scraps.
He's like when they invite it's like a YouTuber getting invited to the Oscars or something.
They're like,
oh my God, I can't believe it. I can't believe I'm here. They're just like so excited.
Kompany's like a 17-year-old kid whose fake IDs work for the first time to get into a club. And he's like, my God, this is exactly it. I have no idea what's going on.
He's like, this is sick. These girls are 19. Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. Go and talk to them. No idea what to do.
Absolutely not, mate. I'm 15.
Completely out of my depth. I'm going to stand in the corner on my own and drink a Smirnoff Ice and then go home.
And I'm gonna tell my male friends that I've got a condom in my wallet, just so they know that I'm real.
Like, company is just happy to be there. And maybe I'm trying too hard to put it like a positive spin on this, but that could benefit Byron in the fact that, like, maybe they will benefit from a bit of backseat driving. They'll just have a guy who does what they want as a club, and their squad is actually, in my opinion, in a pretty decent position. Domestically, you know, while they had a pretty torrid time last year, it would be difficult to see them not be in genuine contention for the Bundesliga in consecutive seasons. So I would imagine they will be genuine contenders this year. They started pretty hot as well. You know, Kane, they obviously battered Dynamo Zagreb earlier in the week. I think it was 9-2. Harry Kane's now scored seven goals in his last two games, like, which is mental. And, you know, yeah, like, Olise, he's already got three goals and 2.790s. And they've still got, like, the returning talents of Musiala, Kimmich, Sané, Alfonso Davies, Matthijs Tel, Goretzka, Gnabry. Like, there is a good squad there. There's a good stable of players there. And even though company's role is, like, potentially a glorified babysitter, if the collective decisions being made are correct, I don't see there's a reason why they can't have a successful year. And what's also interesting is that they've got the second easiest draw, according to Opta. So in a season that we're talking about being longer, being more intense, being more difficult to navigate, not only do Bayern Munich have the luxury of playing a shorter season than anybody else outside of Germany, they also have the second easiest draw. The only team with an easier draw than them is Celtic. So realistically, of the people capable of winning the tournament, they have the easiest draw. So they've got Barca away from pot one and PSG at home. So they've avoided Liverpool, they've avoided Real, they've avoided Inter, avoided City. And then they got Benfica and Shakhtar from pot two, when they could have gotten Arsenal, Atleti, Leverkusen, Atalanta. So, and then pot three and four, all fairly fodder. Villa away might be a little bit tricky, but sure. They have a... Of the draws, they have a fairly favourable one. They have a shorter season. They've made some good additions, in my opinion. And, yeah, I think, like, I just can't see Bayern being as unsuccessful / unlucky as they were last season, this season again. I just don't think the probability is just too low for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I think they'll be worst competitive in the league. Like, more than competitive in the league. And if this just feels like a Bayern team that will kind of stroll its way to at least a quarterfinal.
I think people always say it about Real Madrid, and I think it might be true in, like, key moments of games. But, like, people talk about teams that, like, coach themselves. And, like, I do think that against fodder, Bayern Munich do coach themselves. Like, yeah. if I pick a team, if I was put in the job, they put me in the job, like, on the day of, like, a match against Dinamo Zagreb. Yeah. I just pick a team. And, like, before that game, I almost put a bet on it. And I said to my wife, I was like, this game will be, like, 7-1. They'll concede, but they'll score a ton of goals.
Yeah.
And then I looked at it later and I was like, oh, 90. Like, okay, yeah. Sure. Like,
also, three penalties for Harry Kane. Hat-trick penalty.
Of course. But I was just like, that's what happens. Like, in those sorts of games, like, they just don't require management. It's just not important. So here, you know, Barca away, yeah. Tough team, flick away, interesting. Like, Luis Enrique, PSG. Unai Emery as well. Like, good coach. That's an interesting... Like for a manager of companies, like, inexperience, that is the sort of game where I would quite like to see a sign from company that he can, like, out-coach somebody. But it depends when that comes in the kind of, like, schedule list, and it doesn't really matter that much. I don't know. I think I agree. I think Bayern are just going to be, like, fine to a point.
Yeah.
And then the question, and then it'll be interesting to see whether either the just, like, outrageous talent is enough to see them through, or whether company actually has the chops to, like, out-coach the better managers in the competition, to out-coach, I don't know, whoever it might be, like Inzaghi, Pep, Arteta, Slot, Gasperini, like all the interesting coaches.
Nothing has shown so far in his career, managerial career, that he does have the capability of doing that.
Sure, but I mean, it's possible. And, like, when you... And maybe those are games where being a little bit less, I don't know, like, so, sometimes I think, what would happen if you just rolled a team out to play, like, their exact same game plan and it didn't matter who it was against? Like, I don't know, like, maybe it'd be okay. Like, if you just sent Bayern out and you were like, okay, Bayern, like, you've got a bunch of good players, go and do some shit. But you put, like, Palinha in midfield and you said, your job, João Palinha, is to give, like, Rodri the worst day of his life.
Sure.
Like, just hunt him down, don't give him a moment on the ball, clatter the fuck out of him.
Yeah, just,
like, elbow him, pull his pants down, like, just annoy him.
Instructions from Sir Alex Ferguson. against Barcelona.
Yeah, but look, I don't want to put Paulinho in the same category as Jason Park, because Jason Park was like a very talented, intelligent footballer. And Joao Paulinho is like an angry Portuguese man. But those are the sorts of games where I think, like, having that guy in there is not the worst thing in the world. Like, go and send him out there and just be like, make this evening miserable.
I think that is what Bayern have been missing for in a lot of their squad. Like, just a combative, blunt instrument in midfield.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with these teams. We'll cover another few over on the paid side. But before we get there, we're going to open up the burn book. Okay, burn book time, Pete. Do you want to start positive or negative?
I'm going to start negative.
Okay.
Do you want me to start or show you?
You can start. Sorry, I've just got a notification about some boots that I've got coming from Italy.
That might be one of the most Patrick Van Straten sentences ever.
Bro, I got a fucking problem. Like, the last couple of weeks, I was just like, so often I thought, you know what, I'm just going to sit down and watch, you know, watch half an hour of something before bed. And then do you know what I ended up doing instead?
Shopping.
Combing watch auctions online.
Oh, okay. I feel like I might have had heavy influence in that.
Yeah, like last night I was just like, I really wish that my wife was receptive to a conversation about whether it's better for me to just spend like a grand on a watch.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not solid gold, or whether, you know, because of the investment value, it's actually better for me to spend significantly more than a grand, but on a watch that is 18 carat, you know, solid gold.
And will retain value, just...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? So I went through this argument internally to be like, can I present this in a way that's not going to get my wife to tell me to fuck off? And I ultimately decided I couldn't do that. Yeah. So I just had it internally instead.
Interesting. I always win those internal ones.
That's good.
Rarely try them out externally. So
I tend to reach the point where I'm just like, what could I do with this $2,000? And I think
I could
pay for nursery for a month. we could go on holiday.
I was literally looking at a camera last night, and I was like, oh, I just don't need to spend it. Like, this one, I can just go so much better places.
You were looking at what? A camera?
A camera. Yeah. The Fujifilm X106.
Okay.
Yeah, just a nice camera, but it's quite compact, and it's like a does everything kind of thing in a small kind of capsule. But they're like £1,600, which I don't need to spend.
Well, not when you could spend. Well, you could put it in the Patek Philippe fund.
I could put it in the Patek fund,
Calatrava fund.
That fund doesn't really exist. That's just my credit card for whenever the right one comes across. I'll be like, I'll deal with that later. Like, that's a bridge I'll cross when I have to. We've gone really off topic here. I was about to say, before we started this section,
this is the most on topic we've been all evening,
that we're doing really well for time, much better than usual for time.
All right.
And then we just go off on a tangent.
Give it to me quickly then. What's your negative?
My negative, what I'm putting in the burn book this week, queuing in pubs. So this is the single file,
right?
Queuing in pubs. This needs to just be outlawed, banished immediately. So this was obviously born out of like COVID, social distancing, when pubs reopened or whatever, like people wanted to respect personal space and limit the spread of like germs, etc. That's fine. That was era appropriate then. So you would go and you would queue in a single file in front of basically like one of the tills at the pub waiting to be served, as opposed to the traditional spread across the long wide bar in a horizontal formation that goes two or three deep. And there's a lot of things from COVID that have stayed, like working from home or remote working, hybrid working. Those are good things. Like, those are things that happened because of COVID, and then after kind of COVID died down, or the COVID like that flu itself kind of just became a rotational flu in the flus that go about every year, and it's no longer in any way near as severe as it was, or as fatal as it was.
Mm-hmm.
Life kind of went back to normal, but we kept the things that we liked. So we liked the freedom that hybrid working give us. You know, it's nice for people to be able to work from home when it suits them, or work from home Monday and Friday. That's nice, and you only need to go into London 3 times a week. This is all things that we realised they don't damage our productivity or whatever, but we prefer them, so we'll keep them. The one of the things that has stayed that has no business in day-to-day life post-COVID is queuing in a single file in a bar, because it is one of the most stupid things ever, right? Because obviously, functionally, it works, because it does create order, and in terms of like who was there first, it does really codify that quite well. But that is not what queuing at a bar is about. Like, there's a real tactic to queuing at a bar. in the old way, when everybody's spread across the bar. Like, mm-hmm. where you choose to stand. Are you going to stand behind the pumps? If you are, you're an idiot, because way slower service there. You can't be seen.
Yeah.
Bartenders also don't like to try and hand like drinks over through the pumps while people are pulling, etc.
Sure, yeah.
Real rookie move to move there. Are you choosing to go behind like the group of four girls who are about to order four very complicated cocktails? Rookie move. Mm. Go behind the guy who you've seen order one pint of Carling and yeah. only and go sit in the corner because you know he'll be in and out quite quickly. Like,
there's it's like playing like the slot, like the 2p machines, you know, on a pier.
Yeah. Yeah,
where you're just like, what is the best route. Through? Because you, exactly. sometimes you're like, I can go straight to the bar if I go, you know, to the like little bit around the corner at the end. But yeah. will I be seen as quickly? Like,
but
there's a real like game theory element.
But bartenders also often don't like serving in corners, and there's sure. often like there's often even signs saying no service in this area. All of these things. These are all things to consider. And there was a real there's real art to getting served efficiently at the bar. And it was. Something I weirdly enjoyed.
It does feel anti the spirit of a pub or bar, though, to queue single file, like you're in a bank.
It's just the most, like...
I've never done that in a pub, I must say.
It's just the most wet blanket thing I've seen. I just hate it so much. I just look at it, and I'm just like, it just makes me want to go home. It just makes me want to go home. And then, also, like, there's been loads of times where, like, I've just kind of played dumb and been like, I've just gone straight to the bar and just stood in the acres of space around the bar front. And the people kind of give you dirty looks and be like, oh, do you not see there's a queue here? And I'm like, it's a fucking bar. Like, do you not remember what it was like in 2016? Like, this is what we do. And invariably, you almost always get served in time or quicker than people standing at the back of the queue. It's just, it just doesn't make sense. Also, when it's like a really busy bar and the queue is like 20 people deep, that means that queue, if it's a single file, basically disrupts everybody else in the near vicinity because they're having to navigate their way round a huge queue.
So yeah, sure. It's like a conga line going through the pub.
Yeah, they're either having to like shuffle through it awkwardly and be like, oh, sorry, you know, sorry, can I just squeeze through you? Or walk the whole way around it. And the whole reason bars are designed the way they are is that they can maximize the amount of people standing there waiting for drinks without actually taking up a huge amount of footprint across the bar. And it just completely, like, there's a reason why it's not just a little like ticket machine, like a ticket desk. Like, there's a reason why bars aren't designed like that. This is counterintuitive to that. Stop doing it. Queue normally and, you know, queue smartly.
I've got to say, this hasn't happened to me, but like, I'm on board with you. I don't go in pubs very much,
sure.
but I'm on board with it. I just don't. I think that if I walked into a pub, as somebody who doesn't go to the pub very much, I'd walk up to the bar.
Exactly.
And be like, is this not the normal way it's done? Yeah. Like, I don't know. I think when people like mock queuing, I think that's kind of silly because I do think like queuing is very useful in lots of ways. But I also think the existence of a queue tempts people into quite stupid behavior. You know, the same way that like very often you'll see everybody queuing to go up like one escalator in the tube and there's another that's totally free, or to tap sure. out or something. And it's just like they've assumed something's wrong with one.
Because nobody else is queuing.
Because no
it,
one's on it. Like that kind of stuff. But I don't know. I just think like, yeah, I agree. The bar is made to provide maximal surface area for everybody coming in. It's not the Battle of Thermopylae, like where they've made it narrow so it can only be one or two at a time so they can pick you off as you come through. Like, that's not how it's meant to work. On the other hand, I also fucking hate people who just like decide that they're standing at the bar and have absolutely no regard whatsoever for people who are trying to get served.
Yeah, well, they stand there and drink their drink and that, like, that's their seat, essentially. That's their place in the bar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm like, if you do that, you need to at least be aware that people are trying to get served around you.
I'm kind of
like,
fine with that. I'm fine with it on the corners or like round the corners. I'm fine with it there. Sure. If it's like right in the middle of a busy bar, it's just crazy.
You're taking up valuable real estate.
Yeah.
Like, that annoys me. Okay, good one. I've got a quick one. Stoicism.
Okay.
So like
this is going in or out?
Oh, in. Like, it's fucking annoying. So I have a classics degree, mm-hmm. and so like I didn't like do a, like, we don't really care that much about Stoicism, but Stoicism comes up a lot in classics. You know, it comes up in Virgil, it comes up in Seneca, like, it just comes up. Mm-hmm. And it was very weird then that, like, about 10 years ago, it felt like it was really, really taking off among fucking white guys, like white Silicon Valley type guys, or guys who are wannabe Silicon Valley types, business guys, entrepreneur guys, your Stephen Bartletts, all those boring, talentless, like stupid snake oil selling, irritating cunts.
Snake oil
like
selling.
among all those fucking morons, like, they absolutely love Stoicism.
Yeah.
And it frustrates me because One, Stoicism is like basically self-help in the way that a lot of older philosophy is self-help. Like, a load of it is like amor fati, you know, like you should, you know, like love, essentially love the fate you're handed, love like the life mm-hmm. you're handed with its obstacles and everything. You know, like that is a self-help idea. But my bigger issue with it is that like, we obviously have the philosophy Stoicism, and we also have the word Stoic or Stoical. So, you know, basically to be able to like withstand mm-hmm. tribulations and to be like emotionally robust and all that kind of stuff. And Stoicism does have like a big healthy chunk of that in it. Like Stoicism is about like being resilient in the face of difficulty and essentially being like somewhat unwavering, you know, to kind of know who you are and have like that stability, that solidity in yourself. But I think the reason that Stoicism appeals to all these like white guys is that they think it's about like repression of emotion. The idea that you should control emotion, I think to them is, firstly, it's a very male coded idea. They think like, no, what this means is like repression. And they don't really understand that like, that's not really what it's about. It's about not being like overtaken and ruled by emotions, which is not the same as like not feeling them, yeah. not paying attention to them and not valuing them. Like Stoicism is really about like virtue. The idea is that like you should cultivate virtue and you should cultivate like wisdom and courage and temperance and all this kind of stuff. And I think for a load of these guys, it's become just like a bunch of sound bites that you can say to other men without being like laughed at for being wet. And it frustrates me because I think it's essentially when people used to put like lines of poetry over pictures of sunsets on Instagram. Which is exactly the sort of shit that these guys would laugh at and think is embarrassing. Yeah. But it's the same stuff. And so it just kind of annoys me that there's like this massive industry around it. There are all these guys who are like complete nobodies who like write books about Stoicism, and they use quotes from like Marcus Aurelius, and they're like, oh, what a genius, like Marcus Aurelius, the philosopher king. And it's just like, get the fuck out of here with like telling me how fucking great Marcus Aurelius is. Get a fucking grip. Like, all this kind of stuff just gets on my tits, and it's always like very selective about the philosophy. And I think a lot of it is a misinterpretation of the philosophy. I also think the philosophy itself is like not especially insightful, really, or not more insightful than just like, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy is. Like those two things are actually very related, you know, like third wave cognitive CBT is like very, is very much influenced by Stoicism. But mm-hmm. I just find it annoying how much I see about it. And it's one of those things as well where like always the thickest guy you know is interested in this. Yeah. Always the thickest guy you know, in the same way that the thickest guy you know was interested in Bitcoin, and the thickest guy you know really loved Elon Musk for like a very long time, and the thickest guy you know like bought Yeezys and like fucking loves Stephen Bartlett. And
it's like crystals for men.
Yeah, and it is exactly. It's crystals for men. It's like, and they're like, you know what, like I take creatine, but I don't really work out enough to get any benefit out of it.
It just gives me the shits.
Yeah, it just gives me the shits. And I do like 10 reps really quickly of bicep curls at the gym with horrible form. Like, it's that kind of stuff. So I just find it... It's always
like Alpha Sigma shit as well. I can't keep hearing that everywhere.
Yes, I just... It's like respectable Andrew Tateism is what it is.
If there is
it's
such
like
a
be,
thing.
Yeah, it's like be an alpha. Like, you're a lion. Like, don't fucking like be a little pussy.
Yeah.
You know, control your emotions, by which we mean...
Half none.
Just don't feel them. Don't think about them. Pretend they're not there. I know that this will not apply to everybody's interest in Stoicism. Like, believe me. But I find its presence in the popular sphere to be strange and unpleasant. And I find almost any time that I see any guy talking about it, I immediately am like, my respect for you is just like, is seriously dwindling. Like, I'm not really interested. Like, what are you going to talk to me about next? Like, ashwagandha? Like, sure. I don't give a fuck. Are you going to tell me about Andrew Huberman? I don't care. Shut up. All this kind of shit doesn't interest me. Miss me with that bullshit.
Mm.
What are you taking out of the book?
So it sounds like you've had a real fun week on social media. Being served a lot of inappropriate for you stuff.
Yeah, I do get served it, and I'm just like, even the Romans who like kind of believed in this philosophy or were considered Stoics, had actually like a much more complicated approach to this idea. So like Seneca, like, is obviously often used as an example of a Stoic, and you know, like, with good reason. But if you read his plays, his tragedies, like, he has a really complicated relationship with like some of the ideas of Stoicism. Like, the sympathetic central figures of his plays are often people who do all the shit that Stoics are not meant to do, and actually as well, who are kind of aligned with the playwright. You know, so they kind of perform roles in the play which are kind of like pseudo playwrighty. It's like they're running the play. And so it's quite interesting to suggest, like, this person who is the opposite of what a Stoic should be is kind of like me, the Stoic, writing this play. Like, that's interesting. But I just think when somebody 2,000 years ago has a more complex view of this philosophy than you do, like, maybe you can't be trusted with it, is my attitude.
Sure.
Anyway, what are you taking out?
What I'm taking out, I actually kind of struggled this week to find something. What I've decided to take out of the burn book is actually looking at old photos, or actually looking at photos that you have taken. So we just spoke about the camera that I was looking at, and like, I wouldn't say I'm like into photography, but I'm not into photography. Like, I go places, I like to take pictures.
Sure.
I like them to look nice. I like them to be composed aesthetically. I like them to be graded well and posted. It's more so than just point and shoot. But I kind of find that most of them probably end up on like my Instagram highlights. And outside of that, there's just a load of photos that I've taken of a moment or a trip or some memory, whatever, that will just sit like on my camera roll or on my laptop and just never be seen again. Like, they'll just fall away into the ether, and there'll be more photos added on top of them, and they'll have the same fate. And since we moved to like digital storage of photos, it kind of feels like we've lost the experience of reliving the photos that we've taken. So, because we don't have them in tangible format. So the reason this came up was because my grandmother couldn't attend our wedding, so we made her a photo book on like one of the online services and sent it to her, so she could have the photos of like me and Jess and our family, and like the kind of obviously geared it towards like her relatives involved, like, were featured more heavily in the photo book. But what it meant was, I was doing like one or two nights a couple of weeks ago, I was just like going through all our wedding photos, and the only time we'd gone through our wedding photos was the first time they got delivered to us, like the first time the photographers sent us the wedding photos, like 2 or 3 weeks after we got married. We opened a bottle of wine and looked through them all, and we're like, oh, that was really nice. Like, I really enjoyed that. And then we haven't looked at them since. And then this kind of forced me to go back through them, because I needed to select and upload the ones that were appropriate. And I was just like finding myself like looking through our wedding photos, which only happened like 6 months ago, not even, on my own. I think Jess was in bed. I was sitting on my own on my sofa, and I was like, I'm actually like having a good time. Like, you know, I was like smiling through it as well, being like, oh yeah, I remember that. Like, that was good. It was like really nice to kind of relive it. And it was something that was so simple, and I was expecting it to be more of like a chore, because I'm like, right, I need to put this together. Like, my grandmother will really appreciate this. I just need to do the work for it. And that's fine. Like, I'm completely willing to sacrifice an evening for that. But I wasn't expecting to enjoy it as much as I did. And then the other time that was, I suppose, slightly more morbid, but the other time I enjoyed doing this was when, just after my father died, we basically were going through old photos to try and find good photos for like order of service, for like a slideshow and stuff of like him through the years and stuff. So we were like digging through volumes of old photos in the attic and like scanning them. So we went through like decades worth of photos, and it was actually really quite cathartic and fun to kind of look back through his life, and like my, and obviously I came on the scene kind of into his 30s and later, but it was really kind of nice to go through back all those memories, and the memories that are like entombed within those pictures all kind of come back. And I feel like at least my experience of photography now and taking and storing photos is completely different to that. Because they exist on my phone, or because they exist somewhere digitally, that just get pushed further and further back, further and further down, and they get forgotten about. And it's like, I don't remember the last time I went back and looked at like photos from somebody else's wedding.
No.
And it's like, not that you would do that overly often of tangible photos, but you would probably find a photo album every now and again, and you would leaf through it and be like, oh, there you go, I remember that. Oh, this is fun. And you probably get lost in a bit of a rabbit hole. That's kind of lost for me now, with the whole digital storage of photos. It is still kind of quite difficult to kind of, I suppose, turn that and change that because it was so entrenched in digital photos now. But it was just, it was something that I was like, I'm having a really good time looking through our wedding photos and it's only been 6 months. And it's literally just for one point in one night just to get like a book done for my grandmother. But it just got me thinking about the relationship we have with photos now. And it's just like, photos for me now have almost turned into like what I see or what I always thought taking photos of fireworks was. Like, I think taking photos of fireworks is one of the stupidest pastimes you could ever do. Waste time. Because who has ever taken like 50 photos of a firework display and then a week later gone back and been like, oh, I'm going to, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to spend 25 minutes and I'm going to flip through these 60 photos or 50 photos of this firework display that I watched. Because that's a totally normal thing to do. And that's the thing that everybody actually does. No, what happens if you ever take a picture of a firework display? You take the picture and once that picture's taken, that split second where it flashes, where your camera does that, your phone does that like mimic camera shutter sound and flash, that is the one and only time you will see that photo. You will never see that photo again. It'll stay on your phone forever. You will never see that photo again. And this feels like a slightly less aggressive way of that. It feels like we've kind of gone that way with digital photos now. But it was nice to kind of really, those two scenarios or two that I kind of remember, it was nice to actually look back and kind of reminisce a bit, which was nice.
I really agree with that. Like, it's really easy to just like, you have thousands of photos on your phone and you just won't look at half of them ever again. And when you do look at them, then it helps make decisions next time you're having like a live experience where you're just like, am I going to take a picture of this? And then you just think, no, I'm not, because I'll never look at that picture again. Like, I feel the same way about people taking videos at like concerts where I'm just like, the whole point of being there is that it's live.
Yeah.
Like, if you want to watch it through a screen, you could have stayed at fucking home.
Yeah. Like, I'll probably take a picture of, or like a picture of it to be like, I was here. I'll encapsulate this, but I'm not, it's the 3 minute recordings of the song.
Yeah, you're like, you want to hear like a bad recording of the like blown out muffled vocals through your on hand. The song. Like, sure, great. Yeah, I agree. I think it's really good. Like the one of the good things about having kids is like, we do look at our pictures of them quite often. And then like, you know, my wife makes a calendar for my mother-in-law, like every Christmas. Nice.
Yeah. And so you kind of have to go every year. Yeah.
Yeah. Then she's like, I want to find a representative picture from like every month.
Sure.
And so we end up like looking through them a lot and kind of going back to them. And it's really fun. But the pictures outside of that, just like never look at them.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's a good one. My one, really, really quickly. Do you know what season it is, Pete?
What season it is? Are we into, are we technically into autumn / fall?
Not really the question. We're in light outerwear season, Pete. That's where we are.
So early autumn, late summer.
Yeah.
Light outerwear.
So we're in a period of the year where you could wear shorts if you wanted to, but maybe you could wear those shorts with a light jumper.
Yeah.
You know, where you can go into your cupboard and you can get out your boots that you haven't touched for a few months, your hiking boots, your Chelsea boots,
the ones on the way from Italy currently.
Those are hiking boots.
Yeah.
But like, you know, city hiking boots.
Yeah, of course.
You can wear trousers with no concern. Because even though it was like 24 degrees in London today, 24 degrees in September is very different from 24 degrees in July. It's still cool in the morning and the evening. The sun's not as like harsh. It's much easier, you know. So suddenly we're wearing denim again, baby. Like this is a great time of year, a very jaunsy time of year, where you can start layering jaunsy. Up. You can get your jumpers out of storage. I just like it. I'm more comfortable at this time of year. I find, I must say actually, this summer was a pretty good summer for clothing. The last two summers, I've kind of felt, and I think you felt, we've talked about it here, that like our summer wardrobes were much more satisfying to us than they had been in the past.
Yeah. To the point however, of like, this morning I was actually quite sad that I was looking at a lot of the items being like, your time this year is limited.
Yeah.
Like the seersucker time is limited. And I'm like,
Short sleeve linen shirt I looked at and I was just like, short sleeve linen shirt in summer looks cool and breezy. Short sleeve linen shirt in the rest of the year looks like cool vicar. do it. So I was just like, cool right, vicar, okay.
Terrible alternative to sexy priest.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. so it's just a nice time of year. It's nice to feel like you have kind of like the run of your wardrobe again. It's nice not to have that thought when I'm going out, which is, okay, this might be okay to wear now, but in 2 hours, am I going to fucking die? Like, it's nice not to have that thought. Plus, we're sleeping better, you know, a bit cooler. You can sleep with like a cover on, feels good.
Haven't had the fan generally on in weeks.
I moved the aircon back up to the loft, you know. So for some people, it's a sad time of year, but I'm very content. I'm very content to move into autumn. So light outerwear season here again. It's like Christmas. Okay, I think that'll do for this episode. If you are a subscriber, you will catch us over on the bonus episode. If you don't subscribe, consider doing so. You can also throw us like a couple of dollars a month, like if you don't want to be a full subscriber on Patreon. We have a level for people who just like, you know, want to support our work and like, you know, thank us for the research that Pete does. we also appreciate your 5-star reviews. We appreciate your comments, your questions. It's really, really helpful. And we will catch you in a couple of weeks. Thanks very much for listening. Bye.